ultimately, it means bringing in brand new people, people who don't have traditional planning backgrounds, people with more of a racial justice background, or even more of a artistic background. Because I think the way people who are in the arts think is really interesting. They tend to look at things from a really creative perspective. So I think we need to rethink who gets to be a planner and who doesn't. And maybe it's not even calling people planners anymore, but rethinking who's at the table. And yeah, I don't think you need to be have a planning degree to be making the decisions.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline. All right. So we have Jenna Hughes here, a former colleague of mine and a friend of mine. Thanks for joining me in this interview, Jenna. I appreciate you taking some time today to chat with me about not only the climate front line, but also the urban landscape, right? So could you just introduce yourself?
Sure, and thanks for having me, Alfredo. My name is Jenna Hughes. I am a planner. I currently work for the city of Beaverton, but today I'm just here representing myself. So yeah, looking forward to having a conversation here.
Cool. The first question that I have for you is, of course, how would you describe what you do?
Mm-hmm. So I am a long-range planner, which means that more specifically, I create plans, write policy, code language to influence the growth of the city over the next 5, 10, 20 years. And so primarily I work in land use, but we also consider housing, environmental impacts, transportation impacts, and the list really goes on. So pretty much everything that you see when you go out into the world, the current landscape, that's what we plan for.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? It's something that I think it may seem pretty distant to students who may be starting off in their careers. Would you mind sharing just a little bit of, you know, what it's like day to day in that space? Because I can see it being something that's really, you know, like futuristic and like really complex. So I may not necessarily have the experiences or education to work on it. Could you just ground some of the work you do in everyday tasks or things you would do?
Sure. And planning is one of those fields where a lot of people don't know what it is or what they do, but it really affects all of our lives. And it affects even just like how affordable cities are. It affects climate change. Day to day, it's a lot of project work. So I work on various projects. Some of them are more focused on specific areas of the city. For example, one of the projects I'm working on is the Cooper Mountain Community Plan. So it's a brand new area that was added to Metro's urban growth boundary, which means previously it was just rural farmland, but now we're able to create a brand new community and brand new neighborhoods, which doesn't often happen that you just plan communities from, you know, a green field. A lot of times what happens is you are looking at the current state of the city and you're looking at, okay, how can we create more opportunities for housing choice? And specifically, I look at opportunities for affordable housing. But I'd say I have been more housing focused over the past few years. That's kind of just the current environment of we were in a housing crisis and a lot of people are experiencing displacement. But there are certain specialties that you can go into and in planning. Some people are environmental planners, so they look at protecting natural resources. So that's writing rules and policy language that says, okay, we need to do these specific things, or, you know, tell people they need to do specific things in order to protect natural resources like rivers and whatnot. And then some people are more transportation planners. So it's a lot of research, honestly, on the day-to-day, but it is also a lot of community engagement, which is really important.
Yeah, so it sounds like it could be very specific to a niche. And I like how you already touched on language, because the way I experienced urban planning as well is a lot of language. You know, you may be doing a couple maps here and there, but language is pretty important throughout. Would you mind just sharing why this work is important to you?
Yeah, this work is important to me because, again, as I said, it affects everything that we touch on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. It affects how you get to work, where you live, where your job is. But I think it's also a really exciting opportunity to bring about change. And when I mean change, I mean justice too, because we've seen the current climate of just so much racism and classism and climate impacts. And there's a lot of problems to solve, which can kind of make it daunting a little bit, but there's also a lot of opportunities to bring about big change, which is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one of the motives also to just have a bigger influence and change that sparks me into engaging in these types of conversations. I want to pivot into, you know, a little bit of the diction and stories that are around your circles and the systems that you navigate. But I'm curious to know just a little bit of, you know, the language that you use in every day and, you know, the foundation of it, because for someone who's new to this, they may not know some of these terms. So I'm curious to know if you would be willing to just share your take on how you would compare and contrast redlining and greenlining. What are those mean? It's not just colors, right?
No. And redlining is a term for those listening and unaware. Redlining is a practice that we don't do anymore, but essentially Hulk, which was the homeowners loan corporation, they drew maps for cities where they classified different neighborhoods and areas of the city as either red, yellow, blue, or green. And red line neighborhoods tended to be where majority of Black and people of color lived. And they tended to be very disinvested areas, very polluted areas. And so if you lived in a red line area, it made it very difficult or impossible for you to get a loan. But if you lived in green lined areas, on the other hand, these were areas where the houses were in very good condition, tended to be where wealthy white folks lived. And so it was very easy to get a loan there. So, you know, I think it's important when we talk about the history, it's so important to look at historically redlined neighborhoods and even historically yellow-lined neighborhoods to an extent. Those were neighborhoods that were just one tier above redlined, but it was still difficult to get a loan there. But it's also important to look at the flip side, which is those historically green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods, mm-hmm. where it was essentially just these exclusive white enclaves. And it was almost impossible for Black people or other people of color to live there.
Yeah. it's really interesting too, I think, for in the pieces that I've read, one term that's used is the projects, you know, you live out in the projects, historically at least. And so I think that's another term that's used. But in terms of greenlining, would you associate greenlining with single family units? Or could you just elaborate more on the language that's behind red and green lining? What does that look like for someone that's living in those areas? How would they experience that in terms of the language they use?
Sure. And there's a really good resource, which I can share with you later, where you can actually read the notes that assessors took when making the decision about what grade level to give a different neighborhood. And it was explicitly racist. I think Albina was written about as a melting pot of different races. And that was one of the decisions for why it was given the red grade. And it also, there was language in there about lots of different housing types, the appearance of apartments next to single family homes was considered not favorable or not aesthetically pleasing. Green line neighborhoods are areas such as like West Hills in Portland, where there's huge single family houses. It aligns pretty much perfectly with our very first, and when I say our, Portland's very first zoning map of the very first single family zones. So it does kind of align. I won't say it's perfect because over time we've seen mass upzoning in Albina and now we see it as a super gentrified area of the city. Historically, it's aligned pretty well with the amount of single family versus multifamily housing.
Yeah. Yeah, those are great examples, I think, in Portland. A resource I think that would be great for folks listening in is the book Color of Law, which, you know, outlines a lot of these things that we're talking about. Have you read it, Jenna?
Not all of it, but I've read several chapters of it.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 2 or chapter 3. I think it's chapter 3 that specifically talks about racial zoning. Mm-hmm. And so if anyone was going to pick that book up, you don't have to read it in order. I mean, you can, but that particular chapter talks about how zoning was used as a tool for racial segregation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm excited to dive more into Portland. I think it's relevant to just mention that, you know, this is an issue or a symptom of that happens throughout the U.S., right? I remember being in New Orleans and visiting a friend of mine. And later on, when I Googled his address, it was like, oh, look, it was a red line zone. And the experience that I had there was not the French Quarter, right? Or you go to Oakland, for example, and you're on the west side towards kind of the water area. And mm-hmm. There's less trash cans in that area. You know, there's less sidewalks in that area. And so redlining is happening throughout the whole United States. Yeah, very interesting. Is there anything else that you would want to share as it relates to the language or the history that you navigate in terms of what you do? Is there anything particular that stands out that, you know, someone may walk into the room, listen to this word or this acronym from the street and be like, what the heck are they talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've talked before about being intentional and specific with your language. And I think that's so important. And I always try to use explicit language. I think it's important to be specific when you're talking about a particular community. Just talk about that community. You know, if you're talking about the Black community, say the Black community. Don't use people of color, because that's just gonna people of color wash it. It verges on all lives matter. That's not what we're talking about. And as a non-Black person of color, I don't need to be included in everything. Like, it's okay. Just be specific. I don't need to center myself in everything. I admit, in the planning field and in government, it's tricky. I definitely code switch a lot. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes I am fully aware that I am code switching, but, and I want to be explicit with my language. Like, if something's racist, if I'm like in a safe space with like people who I trust, I'll just call something out as racist. But in other environments, I feel like I've been ostracized and targeted for using explicit language. So mm-hmm. I'd say if you are a person of color in a white dominant institution, it can be really hard when you want to just say what you mean, but there is that fear of people turning against you. It's so political, and I hate that it's so political, but I think if you are aware that you're code switching for a good reason, maybe that makes you feel a little bit better. But there is also that risk of just selling out. And I don't want to sell out.
Yeah. Yeah. And so much of it is just understanding the history behind all this, right? And mm-hmm. being intentional about acknowledging it and then moving forward with it, right? And seeing what that process can be. Of course, you put together a piece that was published on the American Planning Association. Would you mind just giving a couple of sentences on what that was about? And yeah, I'd be curious to know how you elaborate on it now.
Sure. The paper is titled Historical Context of Racist Planning, A History of How Planning Segregated Portland. And this is a piece that I led when I worked for the city of Portland, who I no longer work there, but it's on the BPS website, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability website. And it's a history going back about 100 years, looking at how planners specifically have created and contributed to racist outcomes and the outcomes that are still prevalent today. So this is using tools such as zoning, which I talked about earlier, as a tool for racial segregation. And over time, planners might not have been explicitly racist, but definitely implicitly. And while intent can always be debated, in the end, it doesn't really matter, because you might have good intentions, but you might still have impacts on the Black community and communities of color. And so my paper kind of walks through a little bit of the zoning practices that took place, with some added context of redlining, racist covenants, which were written on beads of people's homes saying that Black people or, quote, Orientals or other communities of color couldn't live there. And these were found in beads in neighborhoods that we walk past or walk through all the time if you're in Portland, places like Irvington or Laurelhurst. So it's really interesting, I think, for people to read, especially if you know Portland or you grew up there, to read about why things are the way they are, why you hardly see any Black folks or people of color in certain parts of the city. Why are people being displaced to East Portland? This isn't by accident. This was calculated.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look through the paper, because you touch on a range of things and provide a pretty good timeline of how things went down, even by to the neighborhood level, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted to just take a second to kind of connect some dots here, because the way that I'm hearing you kind of explain your work, a lot of it is, you know, through an urban landscape lens, Whereas for the climate frontline communities, I think also, you know, I see some parallels between these two because, and you kind of got at this with the previous example that you were saying, you know, with land use, if you're putting, for example, factories closer to some neighborhoods, those neighborhoods tend to be more dense in people of color. And so I think there's a connection there to be made around who are those individuals who are at the front line of climate change and who are closest to the factories, who are closest to the oil refineries, for example, Chevron near Oakland. So although we're talking different languages in terms of communities who are at the front line of climate change and those communities that you are looking to serve through your work, through your advocacy, through your writing, there's some parallels there. Would you say that's fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say they are largely the same communities. The same communities who are at the front line of climate change are the same ones who are being forced to live in neighborhoods that are more polluted or have less infrastructure, have fewer resources. And they're the ones who are constantly being displaced by land use decisions. So yeah, I would say there's definitely a lot of overlap. These planning decisions absolutely affect climate. The decision to, you know, segregate neighborhoods, whether intentionally or not, has definitely impacted how people move around a city, how long people's commutes are to get to work or school or whatever, or to their churches, and how much infrastructure they might have to reduce urban heat island effect, or how much green space or trees they have in their neighborhood, which areas get more funding than others. So there's a lot of parallels between my work in land use planning and climate work. And I'd like to think that my work is around climate justice, because housing justice is climate justice in a lot of ways. And both of them kind of boil down to racial justice because it's the same communities.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for connecting the language there, because like I said, it's once you hear one term, you may not associate it directly with another term. I'm curious to know, just like we're connecting those dots there, the systems and how you engage with government around urban planning are complex. There's a lot of bureaucracies. It's a process that requires a lot of patience and long-term planning, right? If you will. I'm curious to know, how have you found opportunities to engage these communities who are experiencing all sorts of constraints, right? Whether it's displacement, hate crimes, lack of shelter, lack of food. There's a lot of things that these communities are navigating. So it's almost like an art to be able to engage with these communities, because they're not the same, right? They're different. They don't necessarily have a neighborhood association. They don't have a board together that have bylaws. They are constantly moving and not necessarily in one place. So how have you navigated that, and what is that challenge like?
Mm-hmm. I think the number one way that I've prioritize communities of color in community engagement is working with community-based organizations that are both led by communities of color and serve communities of color. So, for example, I've been working with Unite Oregon on a particular project to do capacity building around housing issues. They're going to train members of the community on even just the basics on how government works, how to testify, but also will be educating them on housing issues with the intent that they will then bring that information back to their networks so that they can grow capacity. And so it's a little bit more than just, here's a project, we want feedback on it. It's relationship building with those community leaders. And you really have to know who are the right community organizations to talk to. It's been really great to partner with Unite Oregon. They do really amazing work around just social justice work, housing justice, police reform recently. And we have a contract with them. This is my work at the city of Beaverton. We have a contract with them and we're going to be working with them, funding them for the next 3 years. And I think it's really important. You need to give money to the groups who are doing the work in the community and who are representative of the communities who have been historically most impacted by land use decisions or by climate change. So that's been a really big key, is connecting with community leaders, because it's going to be really hard to connect with folks if you're not coming from those communities directly. It's going to be hard to connect with people who have historically not trusted government or just don't have the resources to connect. Maybe they don't even know like how government is structured. And so it's really important to grow the leadership in those communities so that it's kind of in a way they are able to take that information back to their communities and make it more likely that they will keep coming back and we can continue building that relationship.
Yeah. Thanks for that. You touched on so many things, you know, education, leadership, being able to build capacity within the communities to have them start organizing themselves. And I think that's just so important, that transcends the urban planning world and the sustainability world, if you will, at least. I wanted to share, you know, one thing you reference in the paper you wrote is the Portland African American Leadership Forum, who have a people's plan. And I think it's really interesting to that this plan, if you get a chance to read it, if you're listening in, it's a great resource, I think, because many times I think there's this kind of mental model that you need to engage these communities in a way that only makes sense within the structure of government or within the structure of a certain organization. Whereas I think the People's Plan is an opportunity where the community has spoken about the health, the arts, the environmental justice, youth, and they do it in a way that's meaningful to them, right? And I think that's different than the processes inside of government. And what's so relevant in this plan that you're kind of touching on is that the plan goes on to give specific direction to different government branches of Portland, which lets you know that there's been like a capacity building and leadership building work that has taken place, because for many of these communities, they may not be able to differentiate between one office, one bureau, or so on and so forth. So I don't know if you remember, but there's actually a section in the plan where they had a campaign saying to advocate for the next mayor. They had postcards saying, "Dear next mayor." Yeah, I was curious to know a little bit, you know, given what's going on in the US and in Portland, you know, given the experience you have and the work you're doing, if individuals were to fill out these cards today, what would they be writing in to the next mayor?
Oh gosh. That's up to the people to decide. I don't know if that's up to me. Wait, can you rephrase your question?
Yeah. I know that was a lot, right? So part of the people's plan, they outline a campaign, where they wanted to build capacity and, you know, leadership to have individuals voice their concerns to government, specifically the mayor of Portland. And so they have these postcards, right, where you get to write, "Dear next mayor," and they would fill in on the issues that are most important to the community. So I was just curious to know, from urban planning space or land use space, have those things still remained the same, or are there things that are coming up that are new, or what kind of advocacy do you foresee coming into government, or is that a remain the same?
I hope it doesn't remain the same. I hope we're growing and learning and doing new things and taking action. But I think what's new for people, it's not new for me and the people that I tend to surround myself with, but I think what's new for a lot of people is centering Blackness, and also just the consideration of how police are incorporated into the urban landscape, even in ways that you don't really think about. Like, from an urban planning perspective, the idea of surveillance and constant surveillance, and who is that really serving, and does that really keep us safe, and who is that, what is the definition of safety, and how is that,
who is the safety for?
Yeah, who is the safety for? And I mean, just the I've always been critical of surveillance, but even more so. I mean, I read an article the other day that was, it was titled "Whose Space, Black Space," and it talked about, in the urban planning world, we have to stop with planning that is about surveillance. There's always been this like, oh, well, we need more eyes on the street. Why do we need more eyes on the street? Like, on one hand, you're like, okay, well, that just creates more social interaction and public space. But that also means that there are more people policing each other and calling the cops on each other because they see someone who looks suspicious on the sidewalk. And so I've been thinking about that a lot. I think in some ways I have probably perpetuated the eyes on the street mentality without even knowing that it had anything to do with race, because I thought it was just like, oh, well, it makes sense that you would want lots of windows on a building, because that way, if you're inside, you can look outside and you can, you know, you can see what the weather is and it's whatnot. And you can look at the flowers and the trees, but you're also, if you're on the inside and there are tons of windows and you're looking outside, you're also, if it's the wrong people, you are policing others and how they use public space. So I've been thinking about that a lot, and just how we need to rethink how we do urban planning, urban design. It's something that I had a feeling, I mean, I already knew that urban planning around here is very Eurocentric, but now more than ever, there's evidence that it is explicitly anti-Black. Mm-hmm. And so that's been really a new topic and a new space for a lot of people. And I've had some really great conversations about how to dismantle the blatant anti-Blackness that is in urban planning.
Yeah. So tell me, if you had an opportunity to, you know, lead some of that work, and I'm curious to know what that would look like for you, given that you're saying there needs to be a reframing of how you do engagement so that perhaps there's less eyes on the street, or, you know, if it is very Eurocentric, what does it look like for diverse communities.
Mm-hmm. And I think not to take the easy way out, but I don't know if I'm the right person to be leading that. I think it's hard because it's a profession that's already so white and so diverse. And as a person of color, yeah, I bring some diverse perspective, but as a non-Black person of color, I don't think I'm the right person to be making decisions like that. I'd really like to be in on the action though, because I have the drive and I think I have access to a lot of resources and tools to make things happen. But ultimately, it means bringing in brand new people, people who don't have traditional planning backgrounds, people with more of a racial justice background or even more of a artistic background, because I think the way people who are in the arts think is really interesting. They tend to look at things from a really creative perspective. So I think we need to rethink who gets to be a planner and who doesn't. And maybe it's not even calling people planners anymore, but rethinking who's at the table. And yeah, I don't think you need to have a planning degree to be making the decisions. I think it means dismantling the current system, creating something that's brand new. We already have a lot of engagement in the community right now. We have plans like the People's Plan. Like, let's just have that be our plan. Like, why do we need to create brand new plans that are government and white led? Like, why can't we just, let's just like take a pause and rethink this whole system?
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate you answering that question that way, because I see you being aware of the role that you have, right? And not necessarily jumping into solution, but rather say, that's not my role. And I think there's a lot of awareness that comes with that answer, right? To be able to know who you are and the role that you need to play. I'm curious to know, just because you started to touch on it, what would you say to an artist, a youth artist that may be listening to this conversation right now, who, you know, doesn't know anything about the language in the urban planning space, thinks that the master's degree in urban planning is too expensive, and why would I want to get in that? What would you say to them, and in terms of engaging in this type of work?
Well, for starters, I don't have a master's in urban planning either. So I would say, hey, if you have the drive and you are willing to do the work and do your homework, anyone could become a planner. But I would say that, I mean, if someone with an arts degree and is really interested in the arts, but is also passionate about getting into urban planning and making an impact that way, I would say that there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, again, even just how we think about urban design, why do we need to look at Eurocentric architecture? Can't we look at more, you know, architecture in other parts of the world that are really, really creative and not so white dominant?
There's like a learning journey, right? To undo your racism. There's a learning journey to understand that systems may not be created for some, but be perfectly created for you. And that could apply to many different faucets. You have to start the journey somewhere, right? And that journey hopefully gets you to gain clarity on your role. That's a journey that you started a while back, and you got to where you're at now, where you have some kind of clarity around your role. So there's that journey. Why is that journey important?
It's not that the white folks that I've worked with have been, you know, bad allies, but I think there's just a lot of learning to still be done. But it's interesting what you said is sometimes people just need to learn about what their role is and whether it is appropriate for them to be there or if they should just sit that one out.
Yeah.
And when to lift up the work of people of color and when to just take a step back. And that's something that I don't have a good example right now, unfortunately, because I don't know if I've really seen that. I mean, the journey isn't just important, it's critical. Otherwise, you are perpetuating the systems that created these racist outcomes. I think that people, I get a sense that people are becoming aware of where their educational shortcomings are, and they are doing a lot to educate themselves. There's still a lot to be done, but ultimately, I think through education, through just having the conversations, you begin to realize what your role is. There's no really good answer here because I think it just takes time. Like maybe for people, it's just like literally the constant education and constant conversations for them to step back and realize like, oh my God, I'm part of the problem. And it's like, yeah, that's what we've been saying, but it just takes people longer than others. And ultimately, it's important because this is what people of color have been talking about for a really long time, is like, don't ask us what you need to do. You need to figure it out yourself. Or we've been telling you to do this, to fund this, to defund that, and you're not listening to us. So you're going to get the same results over and over again unless people really go on their personal journey. A personal journey, and also sometimes you just need a shove from an organizational level. There's the whole behavior change idea, like, okay, well, maybe if you just slowly, create rules so that people have less power, maybe over time they'll realize that they didn't really need that power and that was a good thing to give that power to someone else. I don't know. I don't have the right answer, but yeah, it's super crucial to go on that journey if you do feel like you have some learning to do. Don't wait for other people to educate you.
Yeah. Would you mind sharing a little bit of how that journey and role has changed over time for you?
Sure. You know, I've only been in a planner for maybe like 4 years. So that's not a long time, but I've noticed some personal growth. Alfredo, I know we've had conversations in the past, and I look back and I'm like, wow, I feel like I was so ignorant or naive. I didn't understand areas where I walked in and I was like, well, I'm a person of color. And it's like, yeah, but it wasn't about me because I'm very privileged. And I think I knew that back then, but I didn't understand how to center others and even just how much power I have. Because a lot of times in my day-to-day life, it felt like, oh, I have no power. You know, I'm young, people don't take me seriously, I'm a woman, I'm brown. But over time, I've come to realize I am part of the problem unless I do something. So it's been really powerful. I mean, I've done so much reading on my own for fun, not because anyone told me to. And I'm not perfect, but I don't think that's the point. I think the point is you need to move. If you're not moving, then you're going backwards. There is no being neutral.
Yeah, I like that. You've kind of headed towards more of action, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I would say in the past, maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, I was still in the learning phase of like, okay, I need to listen and just take in all the information that I can. Mm-hmm. And now I'm less about sitting around and having processing circles and more about, okay, if you're not on the same page as me, I'm not going to associate myself with you because that's just a waste of time.
Yeah. Really interesting. You mentioned books. I know some of our colleagues previously gave me some books that just threw me for a loop, and understanding the blinders that I had, right? would you mind sharing maybe one or two books that you would recommend folks to read in the topics of urban planning and the space that you engage in? Anything that comes to mind?
Sure. And this isn't urban planning focused, but I mean, I remember the first time I read The New Jim Crow, and I just felt like, oh my God, I wasn't making the connections. I saw the data, I saw the inequities, but I wasn't making the connections as to like why this was happening. And so, I mean, I don't think if you're an urban planner, if you're interested in urban planning and you want to learn more about racial justice and how to dismantle racism and anti-blackness specifically, I don't think you need to read books that are specifically about urban planning. I mean, I think that's helpful, but it's more about just growing your understanding of the current reasons why things are the way they are in society in terms of racism. So The New Jim Crow was super eye-opening to me. I love that one. I did read How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I think that's a book that's been super popular lately, which is kind of funny because I read it right when it came out and I was talking to folks about it and I felt like people were like not really interested in the book. And now all of a sudden everyone's buying it. And it was a really good read if you are just interested in like, you know, what does an anti-racist look like? And why are we talking about anti-racism instead of just like equity? So I would recommend those books.
Yeah.
And honestly, for urban planning specifically, I just read a lot of articles. And I can't even give you like a specific article because it's just like, it's constant. It's like every day I look for articles that are about dismantling racism and just advancing racial justice in planning. It's nothing specific, but I think you get bits and pieces over time that are probably even more valuable than a book because they're more current. They're like, they were written or published that morning as opposed to like a book, which if it's about history, it's always going to be relevant, but it's not about the current events that just happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I think there's a lot of books that are interesting that you mentioned, but also the article piece. Thanks for sharing that. I'm curious what your message would be. I have a couple of individuals that are coming to mind right now who their history and their journey, you know, comes from communities who are at the front line of climate change. And they let me know, hey, I actually want to get in the urban planning space. So what's your message to them? And would you be open to touching base with them? What would that engagement look like for you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, if anyone wants to chat offline, I am happy to just be very blunt about what it's like. And it would be awesome to just have more diversity in the field, not just, you know, especially diversity from people who have a non-traditional planning background, people who maybe studied something else, but now they're looking into how the urban landscape really affects everything. But I would say if you're interested, let's talk. Like, I'd love to hear about what you're interested in, why it's important. I can definitely share a lot about why it's important. Because urban planners historically have gotten away with a lot. I mean, straight up, like, gotten away with murder. And I know all eyes are on like the police right now, police reform, but there's so much reform that needs to happen in planning and related fields. And it would just be so great to have more folks who are already willing to make change. So yeah, if you're listening, let's talk.
Okay. And what would be the best way for them to contact you, if you don't mind sharing?
Probably email. My personal one is jhughes@berkeley.edu. And yeah, just send me a note and we can set up a call. Or yeah, it's probably, we're going to be in this pandemic for a while, so probably not good to meet up in person, but the call works just fine.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. You've heard from Jenna. She's open to hearing from you if you're listening in. Jenna, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me. Would you mind just sharing, who you are as a person and what are the things you like to do in this journey called life?
Sure. That's like a big question because I don't generally like talking about myself, but I'll say that I am I talk I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I am Filipina, and so I'm a proud Filipina, and so I really am passionate about connecting about Filipino and Asian Pacific Islander culture. I was born and raised in Oregon, grew up in Tualatin, but I've lived in the Portland area my whole life. I'm more of an introvert, but if I'm really passionate about the topic, I will just keep going on and talking about it. I'm very passionate about climate justice. A lot of people don't know this, but I actually studied sustainability in my undergrad. So my whole reason for coming into planning was because I was like so enraged about climate change and wanted to do something about it, and was like, I'm a tree hugger and all about sustainability. And I still care about that, but it's just funny how my focus has shifted so much to housing issues. In general, see, when I'm not in a pandemic, I like traveling and kickboxing. I would say playing ukulele, but to be honest, I haven't touched it in a while. I need to pick that up, and singing karaoke.
That sounds great. So, if you're looking for a connection that can do some kickboxing lessons with and maybe kickbox out some urban planning laws, then we know who the person is to reach out to, right?
That's me.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Jenna. Anything else you want to share or shout outs, anything that you want to put out to the world here?
Shout out to Alfredo for having this podcast in this forum just for discussing these types of issues. This is awesome.
Folks, welcome to my community. I am really excited to get started and speak with different leaders across industries. If you have a second, please check out the website www.climatefrontline.com, where you can find out more about the podcast, about myself. You can also suggest future guests for the show and questions you may want to ask in future episodes. So I am excited to get that going. Thank you so much. The communities who are experiencing the worst effects of climate change are those who are best positioned to innovate solutions. Thank you for tuning in and being part of Changing the Narrative. See you next time at the Climate Frontline.